Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. Today we are continuing with what we have been doing this week around strange laws from around the world. And this one takes us to the western part of the world, not to the United States, a little further north in the United States, in Canada, a town known as Oshawa in Ontario, Canada, has since 2008 had a law that has prohibited the interference of any tree located on municipal property. Specifically, it is illegal to climb trees in Canada. And the main reason that the Canadian law was put in place, according to the Canadian lawmakers, is that it was aimed at preventing citizens from trying to act like Spider-Man. Hey, what a movie. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Moyahan. On the show today, we take a look at the executive orders, amongst other things, that have come out following President Donald Trump's inauguration yesterday, or late last night. We got a list of things that he signed in as executive orders and signing out some old executive orders as well. We're going to speak to Dr. Azhar Jameen of Econometrics around that and try and understand what the Trump presidency means for South Africa. We're also going to take a look at the proposal to list SOEs and whether or not that's a good idea from South Africa's perspective. We're going to be speaking to independent analyst Kaya Sitole around that. And then we've got a conversation around your data security, particularly in the context of credit bureaus and the National Credit Act. It seems that there is some loopholes in legislation that is allowing for the National Credit Act to share your personal information with credit bureaus without your consent. And we're going to look at the implications of that, given that credit bureaus have recently been hacked and South Africans have lost money as a result of that. And then we're going to wrap the show up with look at a property feature. We're going to be looking at home trends and property trends for 2025. We're going to be speaking to the team at Uber Home Loans around that.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We kick off the show, as we always do, with a sense of how the markets have been moving. I'm joined on the line by senior market analyst at XNest, Terence Hove, to do that. Good evening, Terence. Lovely to catch up with you. It's been a rather calmer day today than it was yesterday, depending on which markets you were looking at. Markets seemingly rather positive around the fact that the Trump inauguration has finally been concluded. Equity markets having a good day, even the Rand gaining a bit of ground against the dollar.
Yeah, good evening, Jimmy. Great to be back on the show. I think all eyes and attention was definitely on yesterday evening, early evening our time, you know, when U.S. President Trump took oath of office. So I think that especially on, you know, the subsequent actions of what he did, you know, signing those orders. And I think that's where the market jittery was, you know, leading to the day, to say to what extent and, you know, what level of detail is he going to proceed with. So I think there's still a lot of moving parts, you know, from the orders that were signed in. So the outlook now is for us in terms of, is it favorable for us? I think time will tell, especially trade-wise. But certainly, you know, markets are responding positively from a Rand perspective. And, you know, yeah.
Terence, when we look at some of the other market movements, I mean, the Rand gaining a bit of ground against all of the major currencies there. But when we look at something like Bitcoin that hit all-time highs ahead of that inauguration, Trump has obviously been pro-Bitcoin. We saw a bit of retracement. We're now seeing Bitcoin kind of back closer towards the $100,000 level than towards the $110,000 that it was yesterday around this time. What do we make of that? I mean, obviously, a lot of it was just potentially buy the rumor, sell the fact kind of movements. But are we still optimistic about other areas like the crypto space when compared to things like equity markets?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, Jimmy, I think sometime last year we spoke on Bitcoin and where it could go. And I mean, look where it is, way past 100. So Bitcoin is still very much in play. I mean, there's still a lot to come from President Donald Trump when it comes to crypto industry. I mean, over and above crypto, just fintech alone. His inauguration yesterday was very testament to that. I think that's been a lot of the market headlines, you know, all those, you know, tech executives that were there. So when we look at Bitcoin, there's still a lot more room for it to run, especially when the actual policies start coming into place. And I think the price movements that we're seeing is the speculative nature of, you know, Bitcoin, because it is a very popular cryptocurrency. It sees a lot of flows, and probably at those higher levels, there was quite considerable profit taking. You know, which pushed the price lower to about 102, to the 102 level. So, you know, providing support there. And we're starting to see buyers coming back strongly into the market, those that are favoring that to be a very good level to get in at the moment. So I think, you know, Bitcoin will remain volatile as it is, you know, being quite speculative, popular speculative instrument, if I can call it that. And then from the investment perspective, I mean, we can't ignore how the return of Bitcoin has been over such a short space of time, especially in comparison to equities. So I mean, of course, it's always volatile, you know, it then drops significantly, but similar to equities. I mean, a stock could sell off significantly. So I think Bitcoin is still very much a very attractive instrument, and cryptos being an asset class are very attractive leading into the Trump administration.
Terence, I want to look at commodities. They have also been kind of doing well, especially gold since yesterday. Gold price back north, closer to the $2,750 range. I mean, we kind of struggled to break back above $2,700 at some point, and now it looks as though there's very little that can stop the gold price. What are your thoughts around the gold price, but also other commodities like platinum and the Brent crude?
Yeah, so if we look at the gold prices, it's for me, gold is always a good indicator of the risk that anticipated in the market. So moving higher is showing that the market is, you know, moved into a risk, you know, off sentiment. You know, there's a risk element that is, you know, driving this move higher of gold, in particular, you know, with the inauguration yesterday. So there's a lot of concerns, especially around trade. You know, would there be full-out trade wars? I mean, China is buckling down. They're getting ready for the Trump administration. So there's a lot to see unfolding there. And I think that's the risk that we're seeing starting to push the price of gold higher as well.
Terence, when we look at some of the local movements, I mean, you mentioned, of course, that some of the equities that were seemingly under pressure or not really doing so well, not really favored, are now starting to come back. And I'm looking at some of them locally as well. We're having some really good movements, the likes of MTN doing about 5% today as well. Are you liking any particular sectors going into 2025 that you think might be offering value to investors?
Yeah, I think global sentiment-wise, especially with the resources, it's going to be very interesting to see how, you know, 2025 is going to play out, because I think with the Trump administration, the promises that he's made and putting America first is going to probably see quite a shift in trade. So now, is that going to be very positive for us? And how is China going to position itself in terms of pushing for more economic stimulus, a more vibrant economy? Are they going to consume more resources? And you know, if it plays out to be that, then this sector will likely perform well. And I think the retail sector now is also one to watch because of a lot of these moving parts. I mean, I read earlier Governor Kanyago mentioning that there's a lot of moving parts, but it reduces the expectation of cutting rate a lot. You know, rates a lot more going into 2025 than previously thought. So possibly less rate cuts if these policies turn out to be inflationary. And if that's the case, then the consumer, you know, in the retail industry might, you know, remain constrained, because we need rates to move quite lower for that disposable income to grow for consumers. So the retail sector is going to be interesting to watch going into 2025 and resources as well.
Mm-hmm. Terence, you mentioned obviously the comments from Governor Khanyago, but there were also other comments from the IMF that I picked up on today. IMF has come out to revise South Africa's outlook down again. It looks like we're being revised down to kind of where we were in 2024, about 0.8% growth for the year. Do you think that that revision to the downside is highlighting some of the concerns that you might be looking at as well, or is the overall sense of just waiting for markets to settle weighing a lot on some of the sentiment from around the world?
Yeah, I think the primary driver there definitely, you know, what they're looking at is risk factors in that rating. I mean, the finance minister also came out saying it about 2027 will come out of junk status. So there is a goal to mitigate, the outlook or the rating for the country. But I think there's a lot of, you know, structural issues and you know, aspects that still need to be completely addressed, you know, to also support that improved outlook, as the finance minister, you know, advised that 2027, expecting South Africa to come out of junk status. But that would need a lot of, you know, structural changes and improvements, you know, within the South African system.
So lots still to do, but we are seemingly on the right track. Things are looking more positive as we start off the year, and hopefully markets can continue with this positive sentiment and the positive direction. We'll leave the conversation there, Terence. Thanks as always for the time and for the insights. Terence Hove, Senior Market Analyst at Xness, joining us to take a look at some of the market movements today, as well as some of the global factors that could be affecting markets.
Money rules. Money.
With interest rates dropping, is it time to refinance your mortgage? In this week's episode of the Money Rules podcast with me, Bidumela Ntsoko, I chat with Dawn Riddler of Rexilum Invest about the benefits, risks, and different refinancing options available and how to secure the best deal. To listen to this and more Money Rules episodes, go to moneyweb.co.za or the MoneyWeb app.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So last night was the official inauguration of the 47th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. And as expected, it was not without drama and very much in line with what we know Donald Trump to be known for, and that is outrageous statements and even more outrageous actions. A bunch of presidential orders or executive orders being signed in, and we're going to take a look at some of the impacts that we can potentially identify from what's happened from the inauguration and just kind of the tone it's set for what the next couple of years could look like. I'm joined on the line by the Director and Chief Economist at Econometrics, Dr. Azar Jamin, to take a look at this. Dr. Jamin, lovely to catch up with you. It's been quite some time since we've spoken. The announcement, or rather the inauguration of President Trump, much to the joy of the likes of Elon Musk, may not be as joyful for other countries. Let's start by taking a look at the decision from Trump as his first executive order to rescind a bunch of executive orders by the previous president. What do you make of that?
Well, it's quite clear that Trump attitude towards the U.S. economy and how it should be run contrasts massively with that of the Democratic Party. And he had threatened, there was a huge rally, a pre-inauguration rally on Sunday, at which he made it quite clear that he was going to rescind a lot of the moves made by the Democrats. And he gave all the rationale for why they had done such a bad job, according to him, and why he was going to reverse that.
Dr. Jamin, there were also some interesting executive orders that were signed in by President Trump around withdrawing from the World Health Organization, but also withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement. Now, the U.S. has historically been significant players at both of these conversations or at both of these kind of agreements in the past. What does this kind of move mean? Obviously, we understand that the executive orders still need to go through the respective voting processes and all of that. But this is a very clear statement from President Trump around what he views that America should no longer be a part of.
Very much so. What it does do is to isolate the United States significantly from the World Economic Order. And it will obviously inflict damage on the WHO because the United States accounted for 18% of its revenue. And so it won't have the financial means that it used to without the help of the U.S. But it does mean that the rest of the world is going to go its own way separately from the United States, and the U.S. will not be able to exert all that much influence on some of these developments, including, as you mentioned, also the Paris Accord, which is a move to try and move the world towards attacking climate change by reducing dependence on fossil fuels. Under Trump, the approach is going to be exactly the opposite. It's going to try and encourage independence of energy, dependence on energy sources from elsewhere, and trying to promote the development of fossil fuel industries, oil, gas, and that within the United States itself.
Dr. Jamin, what does that particular withdrawal mean for the rest of the world? I mean, the entire concept behind the Paris Accords was transitioning towards more climate-friendly resources, and also a huge component of that was that countries that historically benefited from the use of fossil fuels in industrialization, the likes of the United States, were some of the biggest contributors towards the global emission problem that we have today. So withdrawing from that is acknowledging that we're not going to do anything around rectifying that. What does that mean for smaller countries like South Africa that are, by comparison, not even big emitters?
Well, it has a big impact upon the rest of the world generally. If you believe in climate change and the damage that carbon dioxide fuels are having on the environment, then, of course, one of the huge contributors is going to be out of the picture. And so the worldwide effort at fighting climate change will take a huge knock. And in particular in Africa, there will still be pressure on countries like South Africa to reduce their dependence on fossil fuels. But there will also be a fear that climate change is going to accelerate without the U.S. being part of it. The irony is that the U.S. has just seen 12,000 houses being destroyed in Los Angeles by wildfires that in the olden days you never really envisaged seeing. So, you know, there's uncertainty more generally about whether climate change exists or not. If you believe that it does, then this is a huge, efforts at fighting climate change have been dealt a huge blow by the actions taken by the Trump regime.
Dr. Jamin, there were some other actions taken as well. There was a very clear statement made towards the BRICS bloc, particularly in the form of that executive order saying that the BRICS blocs or BRICS countries would not be allowed to abandon the US dollar. From a strategic point of view, I mean, the signing of that as an executive order when we already know what President Trump has said in the kind of weeks leading up to his inauguration, what does that mean for where we stand and where the BRICS bloc stands?
Actually, that's a huge red herring. I think the BRICS countries have been talking about this for many years. They've also realized that it is a very far-fetched idea in the context of the present world economic order, that a lot has to happen for the dependence on the dollar to be reversed. And in fact, it wasn't even discussed at a in any significant extent at the Moscow BRICS meeting that was held a few months ago. So it's really just saber-rattling and attempts by Trump to show his supporters that he means what he says, that he wants to make America the great one and to hell with the rest of the world. But it's actually not going to have much impact in practice. The role of the dollar has been gradually declining over many years, in line with the relative decline of the United States economy in relation to the world's GDP, and that is going to continue. But it's going to be a gradual process, and eventually the dollar will not be used by other countries. But in the interim, there's still a long way to go before BRICS actually abandon the dollar as a principal currency through which to trade.
Mm. Dr. Shamin, were there any other executive orders that stood out for you, or just conversations that came out of the inauguration that had you concerned around what the future could potentially look like in a more volatile sense? I mean, understanding, of course, that virtually anything that President Trump says creates some level of uncertainty and volatility in the markets at the moment.
There are many, many areas of uncertainty, and obviously corporate tax cuts is another area. We don't know how much he's going to cut corporate taxes and the potential impact this might have in expanding the U.S. public debt, which in turn raises massive risks to the world economy in terms of necessitating long-term interest rates around the world to remain a lot higher than previously anticipated. And that stands to see a significant slowdown in world economic growth in the longer term compared with what we have seen in the past. The other factor, the fact that really struck me, it wasn't an executive order, was the prime of place given to four leaders of the magnificent seven major tech companies in the world to sit in front even of the Trump family itself, which suggests that, and Trump's commitment to no increase in capital gains tax whatsoever, to work against that, to deregulate. One of the biggest ironies that we're seeing is how Trump's policies are going to and have been contributing towards an escalation of global inequality between the wealthy and the man in the street. And the irony here is that Trump's support came from the man in the street in the belief that the man in the street is losing out to an ever-increasing wealthy class, and that Trump was going to fight against this. So that's one of the huge ironies of the Trump presidency compared with previous orders. But it is a global trend, and it's contributing towards more and more polarization, where the ordinary man in the street, and especially the youth, are feeling isolated and neglected compared with the wealthy, and are gradually polarizing politically between the left and the right wing. And that we're seeing that emerging in many, many countries, and especially in the United States. And that is not conducive towards economic prosperity in the longer term, because it's working against cohesion of economic policies around the world.
The billionaire promised to fight for the man in the street. It's definitely going to be a colorful presidential term, and we're going to see a lot of interesting conversations emerge from this presidency in the U.S. and how it affects the rest of the world. I think we'll leave the conversation there. That was Dr. Azar Jamin, Director and Chief Economist at Econometrics, on the impact of the Trump presidency on South Africa and potentially the world.
My name is Frank Leonette, CEO and founder of South Africa's newest crypto exchange called Afridax. I will be on the MoneyWeb crypto podcast with Kieran Ryan to explain why we believe South Africa could benefit from a new crypto exchange and how we differ from the existing exchanges. Join us this week to find out more.
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb crypto podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb. your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The minister in the presidency responsible for planning, monitoring and evaluation has previously come out to say that we could potentially be looking at listing SOEs. This is part of the National State Enterprises Bill, and this is a conversation that's been ongoing for quite some time. We're going to take a look at this. We're going to take a look at whether or not this is the smartest idea at this point and what some of the merits could be for this. I'm joined on the line by independent analyst Kaya Sitole to take a look at this. Good evening, Kaya. Lovely to catch up with you. A great start to the new year for you, I hope. Let's get right into this particular pronouncement or this particular position from the government's perspective. Would this be something worth exploring? Is it a good idea to look at listing our SOEs?
Good evening to the listeners. So it's a difficult one. And the reason it's difficult is that government has actually been working on a separate process through the National State Enterprises Bill, which is aimed at reforming the way in which all of these institutions are governed. So that's been their fixation for the past 2 or 3 years. They've been developing it, and it actually went out for public comment last week. So we're still trying to figure out how that's going to work. The idea of then listing these particular entities on an exchange is a remarkably ambitious one, which is very difficult to reconcile with reality because, firstly, even in the National State Enterprises Bill, government is still not able to explain which ones are strategic enough for them to invest all of these efforts behind them and which ones are simply less strategic so they can be managed by the ministries where they are. So until we know what the government's definition of an important enterprise is, we don't know what we're working with. But if they are going to be listed, then it's a simple question of who in their right minds would want to invest in these particular entities and what will be so attractive about these entities that it will force investors to redirect their capital from other much less chaotic as private enterprises that are already available out there for capital deployment and then decide that these are the ones where the money needs to be poured. So we actually don't know what the canvas that we're working with is. All we have is her desire to explore the conversation.
Kaya, let's look at the capital raising side of it for a moment. Currently, SOEs in their current form, the likes of Eskom, go to the exchange and to capital markets and issue bonds when they are looking to raise capital. If we go down the listed space and we go into that kind of environment, how does that impact on the capital raising efforts of SOEs?
I suspect it wouldn't at all, because the difference here is that when they go out into the bond market, the profile, the risk profile and the repayment profile associated with bonds is very different to the risk profile that one inherits when you invest in an equity stake in a particular entity. And the simple difference is that, you know, when you have a particular debt contract through the bond, you at least can at least say that I am entitled to these particular repayments because the contract says so. An equity stake is different in that you're the residual recipient of what may remain after all the bondholders have been paid and after everything else has been settled. Now, that works well when the entities are profitable, which means that after they've paid everyone that they owe, there's an amount available for you to receive as a shareholder. Fortunately, the history of state-owned enterprises that they do not know how to make profits. So again, it will be remarkably difficult to imagine how any rational investor would shy away, will move away from the bond market where they can, if they do desire exposure to state entities, where they can invest in the bond market and then decide that they want to be able to buy equity stakes when those equity stakes have turned out to be really not the most desirable equity stakes over the past 20 years. So I'm not sure what on earth the minister thinks the investor community is thinking about the state of these entities. Again, unless we know what entity she's talking about, we actually don't even know where to start.
Kyle, for a moment, let's assume all entities are on the cards here. Let's assume everything's in play. You mentioned attractiveness and a willingness by investors to invest. Given the audit histories of SOEs and the fact that almost all our SOEs have struggled to get unqualified audits in the last couple of years, would listing SOEs, it doesn't really matter which one, would that be something that would be a good idea in the context of the scrutiny that comes with listed entities, because now we're no longer in the realm of just being able to publish public reports. Some SOEs haven't even published public reports in time in the past. Would the scrutiny that comes with being listed be something that SOEs could handle?
But it would be a good idea. They just won't be able to handle it. We know that, because the reason they struggle to publish reports in time is because they tend to be managed by people who are simply not suited for the type of job that they have there. So what would have to happen is that once you list them out there, you actually have to then sacrifice or at least cede some of the control. And that would mean that you actually have to appoint the people who are best placed to run those entities and be able to ensure that they comply with all the listing requirements. Now, that's a bit of a departure from the model that's been in place, which is the model of saying that we regard these entities as an extension of the mandate that we've won at the ballot box. So therefore, we should be able to deploy those that we see fit. That's been the way that these entities have been run. So now you cannot obviously apply that model. You'd have to say who is the person that's best qualified and best placed in order to generate that type of returns that would make this attractive to stockholders, that would make it attractive to bondholders, that would make its listing viable. So it would have to be a big shift in orientation on how the ANC and the government runs the state entities. And I quite simply don't think the ANC has reached that evolution of the mindset that would enable this to happen.
Kaya, something else that comes with listing an entity on an exchange is the fact that you are now opening up yourself up to private shareholders, and we've had the conversations around privatization, and of course it's quite a bit of a stretch from listing to completely privatizing a state-owned entity, but what the government would essentially be opening themselves up to here is things like takeover bids and private shareholders acquiring a significant stake in the business or in the SOEs. I imagine this now creates a bit of a tug of war, because now if you're the PIC or whoever that is investing on behalf of the government and of other individuals, now up against capital in the private markets, you now have to face this as a reality that someone could have more shares than you in the company.
Well, what the minister seems to be thinking, she published an opinion piece yesterday, is that the government is going to seek to retain some golden shares. In other words, they will hold on to a majority stake, and not only will they hold on to a majority stake, they will ink into the memorandum of incorporation that should there be any decision relating to significant transactions or significant business orientations, we will have the ultimate veto right. All very good for her to say, but that essentially forces the investors to say, stay away from this thing, because obviously if a decision has to be made and that decision is not palatable politically, but it makes sense in terms of the business and the business strategy, well, then how do you resolve the tension? The minister's answer is that, well, government must prevail in terms of exercising its golden share to veto those decisions. This simply means that no one in their right mind is going to invest in these entities if that is the thinking that is going to prevail out there. So the spectrum of what ownership might be, you could very well say that the government is going to own a majority of this, whether that's 60% or 80%, but that essentially diminishes the capacity, or rather the pool of potential investors who take an interest in that, because everybody will do their own assessment and then they say, well, hold on, there are many other options here. There are many other entities where we could invest in, where the processes and the practices are in line with what we understand capital markets and, you know, normal businesses to operate in. So therefore, our risk profile is different if we invest in any other entity. If we decide to invest in an SOE, well, we then have to deal with these new permutations and these problematic permutations, well, then actually we demand a much higher return. And guess what? State-owned enterprises are not known, firstly, for making a profit. They're not known for meeting their own internal rates of return. And they're definitely not known for beating the market. So on what basis does anyone put money there?
Kaya, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the initial kind of objective of SOEs was to ensure that the government had various vehicles to do things like catalyze economic growth, like create jobs, and actually build the South African economy by way of things they could control and influence. If we go the listed route, is this something that could potentially still contribute towards catalyzing economic growth, or does that create a bit of a hindrance in that respect?
Well, remember, a lot of these state-owned entities were created by a government that had been closed out from international markets. It was a government that had to learn to do things on its own and to essentially keep the wheels of the economy running in spite of the hostility that the rest of the world legitimately had towards that particular government. So some of them were created with a very different orientation in mind. Nevertheless, some have indeed evolved, and obviously what we now work with is that they have this mixed mandate in that they need to be financially viable, most of them are not, but they also need to be responsive to the social mandate of the day. So that's the reason Eskom, for example, would give some free electricity allocation to the poorest of the poor. Now, when you then put this on the market out there, you firstly are saying out there that you kind of want to work, we want to operate in a competitive space where somebody who does the same thing should be able to say, wait, hold on, we run an airline, we understand the rules to be XYZ, so therefore if the state is to run an airline, the state must also be able to comply with the same rules that it set. It cannot afford to essentially bypass its own rules. So it creates new complexities, and you want them to be able to explain to us whether they are happy or whether they're ready to be able to understand what the market dynamics are, and the fact that if you undermine those market dynamics, it's you're actually engaging in anti-competitive conduct. SAA is a good case study of that. They kept getting fined billions of rands on the basis that they thought that because they were state-owned airline, they were entitled to particular market advantages, which was clearly not the case. So again, the ANC doesn't know what it's trying to do. The ANC hasn't known what its model is. If you go back as far as 1999 on what it said about the fate of state-owned enterprises and what it then practiced since then and what it then uttered in multiple policy conferences and elective conferences, it is a confused party that probably shouldn't be given the freedom to make these calls without it explaining exactly what the big idea is. So I'd hesitate to give them the latitude to even entertain this conversation until they tell us what exactly their understanding of the economy and the state-owned entities and what the open market actually should look like.
More questions than answers, and one of the big questions is to list or not to list. We'll leave the conversation there, Kaya. Thank you, as always, for the time and for the insights. Kaya Sotola, independent analyst, joining us to take a look at whether or not it's a good idea to list SOEs and if it's practical.
The Property Pod.
How is Gidon Novik rocking the retired life? That's a question we ask on the Property Pod in the latest episode on MoneyWeb. No, Novik is not retiring just yet, but the man who's best known for his ventures in the SA airline industry talks about his latest venture into the retirement property market as co-founder of an innovative enterprise called Circle Senior Living.
The Property Pod.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, moving on to something equally as interesting as the idea of listing SOEs is the potential risks that exist in the South African financial system as a result of information sharing. We know we've got the Protection of Public Information Act in place. We know that we've also got something like the National Credit Act in place. But what we might not know is that the National Credit Act allows for anyone with a payment, loan or credit agreement to have their information be submitted to a credit bureau without their consent. Now, this could create a number of problems. We're going to explore that, and we're going to see if we can make sense of that. Joined on the line by Roy Alves, who is the National Sales Manager at J2, to take a look at this. Good evening, Roy. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with the obvious glaring question here around the information gap that's created. How does this potentially compromise your information if a piece of legislation says that virtually anyone with a loan agreement or with some type of legal agreement is able to share your information without your consent?
Good evening, Jimmy. Thanks for having me. It's concerning, right? And you know the famous statement today is that data is the new gold, right? So that information is extremely valuable to maybe someone that wants to use it for financial gain.
Roy, when we look at the POPI Act, the Protection of Public Information Act, that's been in place or that's been enforced more recently than the National Credit Act, I suppose, and that kind of was designed to protect the information of individuals. And when we look at that piece of legislation versus what the National Credit Act, surely there's a conflict there, and one should come out the outright winner here?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, what are we seeing? We're seeing the credit bureaus do not need express permission to process your personal information, whether we consent to it or not. So anyone that you have an arrangement, a payment arrangement or credit or a loan agreement, have the ability to share that info to a credit bureau. So what you're seeing is you're seeing these credit bureaus sitting with a treasure trove of your personal information. And that's what we've seen in the last, I mean, we're talking about the last few months, but over the last couple of years, we've seen the TransUnion breach, we've seen the Experian breach, we're seeing many more of these happening. And in effect, what it means is if someone actually has that information, they can then build, what we call a weaponized attack against an individual business. And we've seen this on a large scale, Jimmy.
Roy, you mentioned the weaponized attacks, and I think back to when some of the credit bureaus were hacked. I mean, South Africans lost something to the tune of 175 million rand when credit bureaus like TransUnion were hacked and information was shared. How does this loophole now further create a problem that we could potentially not be able to solve, because unless we amend the legislation, this is going to continue?
Mm-hmm. No, agreed. I mean, when I talk about the weaponized attack, maybe I could, the SASTA grant one is the one that comes to mind now. Suddenly you've got this treasure trove of information of individuals, and then they go and start creating these, cell phone accounts and start creating this whole physical reincarnation of people and bank accounts and start receiving funds into those accounts. So those are essentially those weaponized attacks. But I don't think the regulator is really looking at it and saying, what if this data is leaked? They're really looking at it from a, I want you to adhere to this legislation, and if you don't adhere to it, I'm going to fine you. But from a practical point of view, I think there's a lot of work to be done, Jimmy.
Now, Roy, part of the information that's being shared and all of that, you can obviously dispute the information, you can request the information, but what you can't do at this stage is you can't opt out of having that information shared. And I want to look at that, because obviously from a legal standpoint, if something is part of a criminal investigation and all of that, everybody has the right to hand over the respective information that authorities are looking for. But if you can't opt out of the information that is shared with credit bureaus, how then is your information protected?
Well, exactly. You can't opt of them not sharing the information, but you can also not go and ask them to have it deleted, which I think is the other concern. So you're at the mercy of them protecting their systems, or at the mercy of them actually not sharing it with further, credit bureaus or potential kind of financial services businesses that want to tap into that information. And that's what we're seeing, Jimmy. We're seeing, maybe a threat actor that impersonates a financial services business and then goes and requests that information. And that is where we're seeing a bit of an issue at the moment. That vetting process on the entry of requesting that information, there needs to be a lot more checks and balances on who's actually accessing that information.
Mm. Is there any recourse for consumers? I mean, understanding, of course, that those who have their information shared through these credit bureaus more than likely have no way of stopping the credit bureaus from being hacked, as we've seen, or any other organization from being hacked for that matter. Is there recourse or any protectionism that can be put in place from a consumer perspective?
Not really. I mean, it could be lodged with the regulator to say, hey, my information or my company information has been breached, and with the hope that there's some sort of form of fine that gets imposed on that facility that leaked that information. But you're not seeing it. We're actually not seeing cyber criminals standing in a court of law and being indicted, I think, Jimmy, is the challenge. And we have a very sophisticated network of you know, cyber criminals, even in South Africa, that see value in that data, and then they, you know, they're harnessing and exfiltrating that data and selling it on to third party companies that then have the ability to kind of monetize that information and that data.
Outside of the value aspect of it, Roy, I want to quickly look at your thoughts around the cost side of it. For victims that are on the receiving end of having their data stolen, this becomes very expensive.
No, it becomes very expensive. And really, once it's out there, there's very little you can do to go and purge it. If your data is sitting on the dark web and has been exfiltrated out of some of these credit bureau systems, it's pretty impossible to get rid of it. Once it's out there, it's there forever. And that's half the problem there, Jimmy, is that information then becomes valuable maybe down the line to someone that wants to go and with a criminal intent or financial intent, in some sort of ransomware, etc.
Certainly lots to be concerned about as consumers and as those who have their data shared amongst these organizations. Hopefully something can be done about this. Perhaps a conversation needs to be had with those that protect the information or those commissions that are tasked with enforcing these legislations. We'll leave the conversation there, Roy. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's Roy Alves, who is the National Sales Manager for J2, joining us to take a look at how the loopholes in some legislation could potentially be compromising our data security.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It is Property Tuesday, and what better way to kick off the new year by taking a look at what we can expect from the property market going into 2025. It seems there's been a bit of a recovery in that space, and we're going to take a look at this and see if we can pick up some interesting insights from that. I'm joined on the line by Corinne McKinnon, who is the Uber Home Loans, to take a look at what's happening in the property space. Good evening, Corinne. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start, before we get into the new year, let's start with how the 2024 year was. Obviously, with interest rates remaining high for the longest time and interest rate cuts only coming through in the later half of the year, I can imagine the property market was still quite pricey towards the end of the year.
That's correct. So definitely, you know, it's been the market's been certainly tougher for the last 2 years. But in October, we actually saw a bit of a turning point where the market responded quite swiftly to the first interest rate cut, which was 25 basis points, which was announced in September. And we definitely saw that our year-on-year numbers and our month-on-month volumes from October 2023 to October 2024 and September to October increased 16% and 27% respectively. So a clear indication that market activity has increased.
Now, Corinne, the property space is quite an interesting space because as it starts to recover, we start to see different trends kind of emerge. What are we expecting for the 2025 year?
So the year ahead, you know, certainly with projected rate cuts, further rate cuts anticipated in the next couple of months ahead, we do think that there's going to be quite a significant market recovery. And a lot of the growth that we anticipate would potentially be driven by first-time home buyers looking to come back into the market based on increased and improved affordability. We've obviously got some regional impacts in terms of what's happening in the Western Cape, which, as you know, there was this immigration trend. You know, how does that impacting the market right now? You know, what's going to happen up north in terms of where the bulk of property transactions actually do and always have taken place? Then, you know, in terms of what we're seeing as well from a trend perspective is an increased number of self-employed customers that are coming into the market. So a few things that we can touch on in terms of what we're looking to see.
Corinne, let's start with the financing side of it. Let's start with the banks. Obviously, home buying is not a cheap exercise, even with interest rates coming down. And we have seen in the past that banks have been quite restrictive in their lending appetites. What are we kind of anticipating from a bank lending perspective and potentially what we might see come out of that?
So definitely the banks are wanting to lend. Banks are looking to continue to exhibit consumer-friendly lending behavior. So certainly in the last 18 months, we've seen significant improvements in terms of banks' lending criteria, the bank scorecards, as well as pricing. So just on the pricing side, just as an example, you know, our December 2024 data saw attractive discounts to the prime lending rate, so up to as much as prime less 0.52%, which compared to the same time previous year was prime less 0.44. So improved pricing from all of the banks and different products that are being brought into the market to help consumers get into the property market. So definitely the banks looking to aid the market recovery.
Karine, what about the consumer side of it? What about the buyer's side of the market? Obviously, buyers have been seeing various adjustments in how they've been viewing the property space. Some have been semigrating, some have been looking to revisit, as you said, revisit the space or re-enter the space following perhaps salary increases and those sorts of things. What do we kind of gauge from the confidence side of the buyer's market?
So we definitely saw a trend in 2024 where there was improved financial prosperity amongst home buyers. We particularly saw in the first-time home buyer space that first-time home buyers were putting down larger and more sizable deposits. So also understanding that the terms that they can negotiate in terms of their home loan are more favorable when you put in a fair size of deposits. So the being that was a trend last year. And although we're still seeing a fairly high percentage of applications where customers are not putting in a deposit, and that currently sits at about 53.7% of on the number of our applications. So quite a high percentage of deals where clients aren't putting in a favorable or a deposit. We've definitely seen an improvement where clients have put in more of a deposit in the last 12 months.
Karine, you mentioned self-employed buyers coming back into the space as well. Why is that important?
So again, I think it will signal market confidence. So, you know, our applications have increased and up to 14% of our applications are now for self-employed. And yes, the banks do view them slightly differently in terms of financials and a little bit of more of the financial implications based on the business. But it is reflecting that the growing economy and the confidence and the increased investment activity in the market, that more self-employed are looking to purchase property. And we do believe that with the bank lending conditions, coupled with a positive outlook, it'll bode well for the demand in the segment, which has already shown some recovery in a short space of time. So definitely there's a lot of people in that market that are in the SMEs in South Africa, and they need properties and they need homes and they need housing. So definitely an improved segment that we're going.
Karine, are we seeing any trends in where people are interested in picking up these homes?
Yes, another interesting trend. And, you know, we've spoken about, briefly I mentioned the Western Cape semigration, which was definitely prevalent in 2022. But what we have seen is potentially the reverse immigration on the cards. We're seeing a turnaround in the growth of house prices in both Tshwane and Johannesburg. That has been on an upward trend since April, and that's certainly signaling this speculative return of home ownership. That, you know, Joburg and Pretoria and Gauteng is still the economic hub of South Africa with the biggest population. So we do think that reverse immigration and the recovery of the Gauteng property market is certainly something that we're going to be watching closely in the year ahead.
Reverse semigration and general optimism in the property space. It looks like it's going to be a good 2025 year for property owners and property investors. We'll leave the conversation there. Karine, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Karine McKinnon, who is head of sales at Uber Home Loans, on the property trends for 2025.
Affordable data is more than just a convenience. It's a real catalyst for change. In the latest Fix SA episode, I talked to George Mendez, who's the chief executive officer of Cell C, about the telco industry's role in driving inclusive economic growth. From empowering underserved communities to fostering entrepreneurship, connectivity is unlocking potential and creating opportunities.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
Just like that, we've come to the end of our show, folks. If you've missed any of the conversations, they will be available online for you to catch up on them on via podcast. You know exactly which podcasting platforms to go to. We are coming up to 7 o'clock. Greg Host is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.